You may have guessed by now that what I'm going to talk about is mind. And I want to start by saying that a couple weeks ago, somehow this memory came to me of Gil saying that an untrained or untamed mind can be your worst enemy. And a mind well tamed or well inclined can be your best friend. And I remember being struck by it when I first heard it many years ago, but somehow it came back and, you know, it just hit me. And I thought, I want my mind to be my best friend. So I began paying attention to the mind. It's not mine exclusively, but the mind, and noticing the tendency to be critical, to be judgmental, to interpret events in a very negative way. You know, somebody doesn't call me back. Gil doesn't answer an email. Oh, what have I done? You know, he's upset with me for something. And of course, that's perfectly silly. Gil is very busy. And I knew I hadn't done anything, but that's the habit of this mind. It goes to worst case scenario, or it goes to what is problematic. So as I was thinking about that, I was reminded of a story that Sylvia Boorstein told on herself, again, many years ago. And that was that she had decided she wanted to go to, I don't know if it was Tassajara, Green Gulch, and she called San Francisco Zen Center, and the person that she needed to talk to wasn't in. So she left a message, and that person did call her back, but she wasn't in. So then she called again, and that person wasn't in. And this time she said to the person on the other end of the phone, I guess that means I'm not supposed to go. And the other person said, no, I think it means that so-and-so isn't in. And I love that because she was telling it on herself and because it's so true, isn't it? We all do it at one time or another. Oh, that must mean, or that must be because. And what a perfect answer. No, I think it means he's not in. That's the plain truth, right? That's what happened. But how easy it is for us to conjure up some big idea, probably according to the habit of our mind. I know it is mine. And so nice to be reminded. No, it means he's not in. So I don't know if any of you know of Byron Katie? Byron Katie is a woman that was spontaneously awakened many years ago. And she developed something called the work. And in the work, she poses several questions. Is that true? How do I know that's true? Where's the proof? And of course, for most of us, most of the time, we think we know it's true. But when we get these questions, oh, maybe it's not. Or I don't have the proof. And so we get to see the habit of the mind. And by seeing it, hopefully, we can begin to let go. My mind still does the same thing, but I can chuckle by and large. It's, oh yeah, that's my mind. Oh yeah, that's what this mind does. Oh yeah, there it is again. And mostly I don't believe it, although I have to confess, sometimes there's a bit of it that catches me. So we have various ways of considering mind or talking about mind. There's big mind in the Zen tradition and little mind. I think in Tibetan tradition, big sky mind. And of course, big mind, you can imagine, is vast, can hold everything, is awakened, is enlightened, is not attached to anything, is free, accepts all. Little mind, on the other hand, you know, refers to these individual minds that have a very limited perspective, have a very limited or a very limited perspective. And the tendency is to hold so tightly to that perspective. And of course, that creates our suffering. And we see it all the time, everywhere now, don't we, in the world, in our politics, in relations with other countries. Each of us and other countries, have such a prescribed, specific view, and that's the correct view, and that's the only view. And it can be so difficult for us as individuals and us collectively to let go of that. This is one of the great blessings for me of Buddhist practice, to learn to hold everything lightly. I know you hear me say it over and over again, but it's so valuable. I can have very strong feelings, thoughts, and then be able to let go of them. Understand they may or may not be true. And that is freeing. That is so freeing to be able to do that and not have to hold so tightly. When we hold so tightly, we have to defend, we have to prove ourselves, our perspective, our view correct. It's a pain. It's suffering. It's really uncomfortable. And to be willing, again, I remember Gil one time saying, you can have strong feelings. You can have a very lively debate. And then when it's over, let go. And I have experience just that. I can picture a certain booth at the Good Earth, probably 25 years ago, having a very lively debate. And then when it was over, both of us just let go. It was great fun, and it was so free to be able to have a view, but let go of it at the same time. So the Dhammapada starts off with a description of the mind. Well, not a description, but important words about the mind. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a never departing shadow. So what does that mean? What is that referring to? All action begins in the mind, begins with thought. And that points to the importance of our thinking, of our mind. Because what we are thinking will lead to what we say and what we do. That makes it so important that we be very careful with our mind, with our thoughts, that we in effect guard the mind, protect the mind, and not let the mind thinking just run rampant. If it does, it will surely lead to suffering. So how do we guard the mind or protect the mind? Several ways. One, we pay attention. We pay attention to our thinking. We pay attention to the quality, I've said that two or three times tonight, the quality of our mind. Is our mind at ease? Is it relaxed? Is it spacious? Or is it constricted? Is it tight? Is it creating suffering? Is it clinging to something or clinging to pushing away something? Remember that grasping can be either wanting more or resisting, pushing away. Is the mind open? Is it open to other possibilities, or is it closed? Is it not willing to allow other possibilities? Can we treat the mind with kindness? Can we treat the mind as if it were our best friend? Ajahn Brahm says, by kindfully looking after our own minds, we become more able to be a kindful force for good in the world. What if you meditated by treating your mind as your best friend? There's a concept, huh? Treat our mind as our best friend and meditate that way. He goes on to say, silence is so much more productive of wisdom and clarity than thinking. And yet the mind just loves to think, doesn't it? Give it half a second, and it's off thinking. But the silence is what leads to the wisdom. So I very much like this idea of treating our mind with kindness. Treating it already as if it were our best friend. So the other section in the Dhammapada, chapter 3, is called the mind. The restless, agitated mind, hard to protect, hard to control, the sage makes straight as a fletcher the shaft of an arrow. Like a fish out of water, thrown on dry ground, this mind thrashes about, trying to escape Mara's command. Mara, you may remember, he's referred to as the king of death, the tempter. Sometimes people call him the Buddhist devil. The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. The mind, hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes, the sage protects. The watched mind brings happiness. Far-ranging, solitary, incorporeal, and hidden is the mind. Those who restrain it will be freed from Mara's bonds. For those who are unsteady of mind, who do not know true Dharma, and whose serenity wavers, wisdom does not mature. For one who is awake, whose mind isn't overflowing, whose heart isn't afflicted, and who has abandoned both merit and demerit, or we say praise and blame, fear does not exist. Knowing this body to be like a clay pot, establishing this mind like a fortress, one should battle Mara with the sword of insight, protecting what has been won, clinging to nothing. All too soon, this body will lie on the ground, cast aside, deprived of consciousness, like a useless scrap of wood. Whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own wrongly directed mind. Neither mother nor father nor any other relative can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind. So it can be our worst enemy, or it can be our best friend, depending on how we take care of it, how we guard, how we protect the mind. In Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he says, the mind includes everything. Everything moves in the mind. Water and waves are one. There are waves on the water, but they are not separate from the water. And though we would like for the mind to be calm and clear at all times, it isn't. Even when the mind is pretty calm and pretty relaxed, there are ripples. but they don't have to be a problem. They're just the movement of the water. And the waves and the water are one. He talks about the weeds of the mind and suggests that ultimately the weeds can enrich the mind. Again, we can have gratitude for the difficulties in our life because they can teach us, they can strengthen us, they can nourish us. If we accept them, if we see the possibility of nourishment and not cast them aside or not fight with them. So there's an article in the August Lion's Roar about detoxing the mind. And I'll just say a few things. The author suggests that the basis of our suffering is our ignorance, including the three poisons, being greed, hatred, and delusion. And the delusion comes from not seeing things clearly, having clouded view, believing the defilements, the afflictions of our minds, the difficulties. One author calls them the torments of the heart. These negative, strong, intrusive emotions and thoughts. And just like Thich Nhat Hanh talks about the miracle of mindfulness, so too, mindfulness, deep mindfulness, can be our most helpful tool in teaching the mind, in taming, not training, but taming the mind. The Rama Viharas, Metta, Karuna, can help to dissolve these defilements, these difficulties. They can be medicine for the illness of greed, hatred, and delusion. Letting go, learning to let be in a way we can't let go. It's a contradiction in terms. What we can do is incline the mind, intend the letting go. And then the letting go happens on its own. We can incline the mind by letting be, letting things be just as they are. And seeing the wisdom of our interbeing, our interconnectedness, remembering that nothing arises on its own. Everything arises out of causes and conditions. That can be helpful to remember when we think that we are responsible for some of the difficult challenges, the defilements of the mind. We may not be to blame for them. They may have been passed on to us. They may have come out of the culture. And of course, all of the above. But we do have the ability and the responsibility to protect, to take care of these minds, our own minds, even if we are not solely responsible for what comes up. I'm just reminded of Wes Nisker, who says, the mind is like a popcorn machine, just throws up thoughts all the time, and our job is to let them fall down. But our tendency is to grab on, and then we cling so tightly to that thought. So a couple of statements I think are very valuable. Greed says, get more. Hatred says, lash out. Both depend on delusion, which tells a story about the world and our place in it that is profoundly convincing and painfully wrong. I like that. Which tells a story about the world and our place in it that is profoundly convincing and painfully wrong. Who we are in every aspect of the self, individual, family, community, culture, is defined by what we crave, who we hate, and what we believe to be true. Again, we see that everywhere, don't we? The tribalism. We're a tribe because we agree on what we crave, we agree on what we hate, and we agree on what we believe to be true. It doesn't make it true. It's a belief that it's true. And I'll end with this. I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related to my actions, abide supported by my actions. Whatever action I do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. And when we read in the Dhammapada that mind precedes all action, all experience, and our actions are all that we have, are all that we own, we see the necessity of taking care of the mind, making it our best friend, not letting it be our worst enemy. It can be either, as the Dhammapada suggests. And we have a choice about how we work with it. Do we create it as our best friend, or do we allow it to run wild and be our worst enemy? I feel more committed than ever to make it my best friend and not let it become an enemy, not let it run wild, but keep it close. Keep it close and keep it gentle. Keep it kind. keep it loving, even when difficulties arise. And that's not always easy, but it's so much better than the suffering that comes with allowing it to be an enemy.
This is Margaret. And I have to say, sometimes I don't feel like my actions are led by my mind. Sometimes I find myself doing something that I certainly didn't consciously plan to do. It has just begun and I'm finding myself in the middle of it. And so I'm not exactly clear if perhaps these teachings about the mind are referring to the intentions, to the intentional mind. I don't know if you can say something about that, but that is a reality for me, that I sometimes am in the middle of something that I never thought about doing. It just took place.
I have that experience too. I think it's not necessarily the conscious mind or the mind that we consider as Margaret or as Burdett, but the way we treat our mind, the way we protect it, our intentions, our inclinations, our kindness, our loving kindness, set the stage for what is to happen. So it's not necessarily deliberate or conscious, but the inclination or the setup has been going on for a long time. So if we have a mind, or if we teach our mind to be open and loving and caring and non-harming, all the qualities that we value, then I think our action does flow from that. Even if you can't say this particular action, I intended, but it's the milieu, if you will, it's the container that we have created of the mind that allows for the wholesome, the skillful, the valuable actions to happen. And remember, action includes speech. If, on the other hand, we allow the mind to get lost in ill will or judgment or criticism or whatever it might be, then our actions, again, including speech, will come out of that. And so are less likely to be skillful and harmless. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it really indicates to me that it's all the more important when I am conscious and intentional to choose actions that support the qualities I want my mind to work from. Because I observe I have enough times when I'm not particularly conscious. So if my habit is to go to the better qualities that I want to cultivate, that becomes my container, even if I'm not quite present at the time. So that's really motivating. Thank you.
It's like the more we cultivate the wholesome, the skillful qualities, the more available they are to us when we need them. Well, I invite you to pay attention to your mind this week. And given the opportunity, incline it towards the skillful, the loving, the kind thoughts and behaviors. But when those defilements arise, when those difficulties arise, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, hold your anger like a baby. Hold it gently. You know, even when things arise that are not skillful, we don't want this forceful, this violent, this aggressive action. When those unskillful thoughts or emotions arise, that's when we, our minds, need our kindness the most. And it might seem contradictory, but we all know that hatred leads to more hatred. Kindness leads to kindness. Love leads to love.